it's complicated, but you know, I think that what I often want people to know is that there's hope, you know, that you don't always have to feel this way about your body and yourself. You know, I thought that this would be my life, or that would be my life, that I would hate myself my entire life and be fighting my body my entire life. And I don't anymore, you know, and I'm relatively young. I'm 26, you know, and like, I've got a lot of life ahead of me, and I wouldn't have that if it wasn't for recovery in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Hi everyone, and welcome back to another episode on the Nourishing Wisdom Podcast. It's so good to be back here with you all. I am joined today by an amazing guest, and her name is Ashley Saruya. Ashley is a therapist, writer, and illustrator who explores the topics of restorative justice, trauma-informed care, weight stigma, complex trauma, Jewish identity, ADHD, and eating disorder recovery. Ashley and I will be sharing a conversation today about her recovery journey from an eating disorder. I am just so grateful for Ashley and her willingness to come on to my podcast to share her story with all of us. I believe that these stories are incredibly powerful because they help us to feel less alone. They provide such validation for our own experiences so that we know that we're not alone and we're not crazy. They also provide us with inspiration, support, and hope, lots and lots of hope. Ashley drops so many truth bombs in this episode, and lots of wisdom, and in the kindest way possible too. So I do hope you enjoy this episode, and as always, may this conversation nourish you and bring you the healing that you need. So Ashley, welcome to my podcast.
And yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to see, you know, what we chat about today.
Yeah, same. I'm so glad we're finally making this happen. It's been
the scheduling has been a bit all over the place, but yeah. Such is pandemic life, as they say.
Yeah, so maybe we can start, you know, with you telling us a little bit about who you are and all of that good stuff.
Yeah, sure, of course. So my name is Ashley, obviously, and I'm a psychotherapist, a social worker. I also do art and illustration, and I specialize in eating disorders and trauma work, and I've been in the field for, almost 4 years now. And I have my own sort of lived experience of mental illness, eating disorders, neurodivergency, etc.
Yeah. Very cool. So, you know, I found you, Ashley, on Instagram, and I was so drawn to your art, your wisdom, and your knowledge on the subject of eating disorders, which is what you specialize in, and also trauma work, right? And so you're very open about your own lived experiences. So that's something that I'm very passionate about as well, which is to value, support, and destigmatize lived experience, particularly in the mental health profession.
Yes, right? Absolutely. You know, I think that, I mean, I don't think it's, of course, a requirement to have experienced these things yourself to be a good therapist, yeah. But I do think that, personally, the best therapists I know are ones who struggled themselves. And, you know, I think that the field is filled with a lot of what we often call wounded healers, It's a wonderful thing, in my opinion, and I think we need more of it.
Yeah. I could feel my heart just, I think we're really, it's a different time now, right? Because back then, and actually, even now, right, the stigma is still very loud.
Oh, yes. I mean, I have a friend who was very outspoken about their experience with their eating disorder, particularly a relapse that they had while practicing. And although, of course, there was some support, there was also a lot of criticism and inappropriate sort of commentary about, you know, how we take care of ourselves as clinicians when we're also suffering, you know, because the reality is that clinicians are people first.
Oh, yeah.
And we do suffer, you know, and we do struggle like everybody else. And so we really need to be, in my opinion, making more space for that, because it makes the field more more effective, in my opinion. You know, it's when you have people who really know what it's like, you know, in terms of struggling, but also in terms of experiencing treatment, you get a perspective that you just wouldn't if, you know, you're working strictly off of book-based knowledge.
Yeah, 100% agree, 100% agree. So can you tell us a little bit more about your experience of recovery and what that was like for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that, like a lot of people, my story begins very early. I can remember, you know, being like 8 and just being really self-conscious, feeling like already that sort of weight stigma trauma had resulted in a hypervigilance about me that really followed me throughout my childhood, my adolescence, my young adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I used food to cope, which, you know, of course, as I learned as I got older, was like the most normal thing in the world. But at the time was deeply pathologized and connected to my body size. And on top of it all, I also often felt physically unwell. Now, in hindsight, I know that that was anxiety. But at the time, it was sort of like, well, you eat poorly or you eat too much and that's why, or you're fat and that's why. So, you know, it was a lot of medical trauma and weight stigma from the medical community, my family, my peers. I was also bullied quite a bit, not only because of my size, although I certainly blamed it all on my size at the time, but I had a lot of social anxiety. I was uncomfortable around people. As I mentioned, I was very hypervigilant. And so I wasn't really able to connect with people when I was young in that way. In any case, things were pretty disordered for a time. You know, I was sort of in that diet cycle. And when I was 15, 14, I experienced a prolonged sexual trauma, and that really pushed me over the edge to some extreme restriction.
Mm-hmm.
And that extended through to the end of my high school career, and then I went off to college. And as with many people, I think, you know, if you go off to college with unresolved issues, they tend to kind of explode.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. You know, it was a lot of binge restrict cycle, like overexercising, all that. And then by the time spring break, my freshman year rolled around, I basically was begging to be put into some kind of treatment. So I found a therapist. And from there, I started to recover, though not specifically with my food. It was really just more like, how do I heal all this self-hatred that I have?
Yeah.
And how do I create space for me to just be me? Mm. And, you know, of course, that involves recovery work, but it wasn't focused recovery work, I guess.
Yeah.
So I worked with that therapist for quite some time while I was out in California for school. And then I came back to New York because I just like New York better. I would say by the time I got back to New York, I was in like full solid recovery. I've kind of been, you know, in that space ever since. I did have a bit of a relapse about a year ago now because of some medication that I was put on, but it was a relapse that was very much focused on feeling food avoidant and not at all about my body, which was a very weird experience for me.
Yeah.
I had never had that before. But so, you know, luckily I decided I needed to stop that medication, and it took me a while to get back to my baseline, but I would say that I'm for the most part pretty there. I'm in the biggest body I've ever been in, and I would say I'm the happiest I've ever been. And the fact that I can say that is quite antithetical to everything I thought as a kid. I definitely thought that my body had to change in order for me to be happy. That didn't come to pass, but not because, the world was kinder than I anticipated, but because I was sort of forced to deal with these things at a younger age than some others might.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's the short, sweet, condensed version.
I'm sure you could write a whole book, you know.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, wow. Wow, wow, wow. What a journey.
Yeah, I mean, it was a long one, but, I think that, as I often say with my patients, and I'm sure you do too, the eating disorder really, it overtakes us in terms of our personalities, our goals, our desires, things that we want out of this life. And, so when I was, for most of my college career, I had really lost my focus, my purpose, whatever that really means. It was all about sort of setting this beauty standard and proving that, I could be wanted. Over time, with recovery, I was really able to reconnect with the things that really did bring me joy and made me feel passionate, specifically like social justice and talking about oppression and marginalization. And that's really, in a lot of ways, that angle is, I think, what saved me more than anything else. Just because it's something that I've always valued. And so it really just connected to something that I knew deeply to be true.
Mm.
And from there, I started unraveling a lot of beliefs and sort of frameworks that had been guiding me for so long, or controlling me maybe. And once those started to fall apart, it was like, why am I even doing this? This isn't even in line with my values. Like, this doesn't even make sense.
Yeah.
Of course, it wasn't that simple, but it was more, I don't know, there was something to me that helped push me in a way that, I think sometimes as we recover, we struggle to find that motivation. And I think the passion for justice, not just for myself, but for others, really propelled me in a way that I don't think I would have had such a quote smooth recovery if I hadn't had that.
Yeah. So something about connecting to community, right? A bigger purpose and speaking your truth and all of that was really
absolutely
helpful.
Absolutely, it was essential. And my undergrad was in writing, and so finding my voice and speaking my truth.
Oh my God, that's so important.
Yeah, it was something that I was, already sort of grappling with. And I actually do try to bring that into my practice now, because I think that in so many ways, when we are able to reclaim our story from those who've tried to take it from us and twist it for their own ends, it is one of the most liberating things in my opinion. And I think it really creates a lot more space for us to be whoever it is that we need to be instead of what others want us to be.
Yeah. Ooh, goosebumps. I mean, you said so much there, and there are a few things that I just want to pinpoint, expand, elaborate, dig deeper, right? So where should I start? Oh my God. So, okay, so first you said this body, right,
I'm the biggest I've ever been, but I'm the happiest that I've ever been. I mean, that is powerful because, I mean, diet culture, the thin ideal, everything that we are seeing and we're consuming online, offline, consciously, subconsciously, unconsciously, is telling us that in order to be happy, in order to be successful, you need to look a certain way. You need to have a flat stomach. You can't have meat on your face. Your thighs should not be touching. You can't have flabby arms. You gotta be toned, tight, and together, right? So how did you get to this place where you're like, yep, this is me, this is my body, and I'm happy?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's a hard question. So how did I heal? You know, it's a big question, but I don't know. I think for me, I tend to sort of be like a fuck you kind of person, you know? So like, if someone tells me that like, I can't, like, I'm going to show you that I can. Mm. And I think sometimes, I mean, I think anger in general can be really helpful in the process, you know, especially in the beginning, because we're taught to hate ourselves and blame ourselves, but really and truly the anger needs to be focused on the correct villain, which is the systems in which we live.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think shifting that sort of self-hatred and shifting it towards the real enemy was really big. Because I stopped blaming myself for the things that didn't make sense.
Yes.
And when you do that, it neutralizes a lot of the shame because you realize like, oh, I wasn't doing anything wrong.
It's not my fault. Yeah.
Right. It's not my fault. I'm not broken. It's just, this is what happens when you try to do this to your body. Like that, this is what it is. And so that sort of like neutralizing it in some ways, reducing the shame, it made so much more space for me to be able to be compassionate with myself in a way that I had never been. Because previously it was like, you know, let's look for all the ways that you fucked up to not get you to the goal that you're supposed to be getting to, you know, because clearly it was your fault because this should work, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, realizing that it was all a fucking lie, you know, it was like, oh, so then why am I mad at myself? Like, I'm not the problem here.
Yeah.
And so that was huge. You know, I think that initial thing really released me in a lot of ways. But of course, I mean, I still lived with internalized fat phobia for a long time. You know, I still do, arguably. And so there was some work that had to be done there just around, like, normalizing larger bodies. And, you know, I often suggest to my patients to make sure that like their social media feeds are filled with a diverse range of bodies, colors, gender expressions, etc., races, ethnicities, because the more that we expose ourselves to different kinds of bodies, the more we're able to see the beauty in them. And I think it was, I think it's Regan Chastain who often talks about that beauty and seeing beauty is a skill. You know, it's not something that, you know, things are not just aesthetically beautiful because they are. We have biases that bring us to that conclusion. And so, you know, we can learn to find beauty in all things, but certainly in ourselves. I also think I definitely reject beauty in some ways, you know, like, I'm not here to be beautiful. I'm here to do whatever I want to do, but it's certainly not to be beautiful. And it's certainly not to be, you know, admired for my physicality. Like, that is not what I want my life to be about. And I think realizing that too was really big.
Oh my God. So powerful.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many pieces to it. I don't, you know, I'm sure I'm forgetting some, but you know, I was extremely traumatized as a child. So, you know, through a combination of weight stigma as well as just experiencing abuse. And so, you know, I had to just do a lot of like complex trauma work to understand that like I was not wrong inherently.
Yeah.
And no amount of like body image work was gonna, you know, was gonna heal me of that trauma. I had to focus on that in some ways and understand that, like, the way that I felt about myself, the way that I hated myself, was not, again, a product of my own making, but a product of my upbringing, and I mean, as well as the culture, but certainly, you know, my house, and just the way that people were spoken about. My partner just came back, so I'm just going to close the door. So
yeah.
Friends.
Welcome back. Well, I mean, those words, they hit me so hard, right? I'm not here to be beautiful, right? And I think that's a big, bold statement, right?
Right. I mean, and I think, you know, that there are some people who, you know, want to redefine beauty, want to think of beauty differently, and I think that's valid too. But I think for me, it's not about beauty. You know, I mean, I think as women, as AFAB folks, as femme folks, you know, we're told so often that our value is in our appearance and our beauty. And it's like, well, what if it's not?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, beauty is so subjective.
It is. Right? It totally is.
It's so subjective. And like you said, right, it's so, how should I put it? The systems that we live in get to define what that standard is. And if you do not meet that ideal or that standard, then naturally you are abnormal or not beautiful. It's so black and white. Or you're either thin, slim, and beautiful, or you are fat and ugly.
Right. Yep. Which is, it is. It does become that black and white in a lot of ways. And I would say that moving through black and white thinking was a huge thing for me.
Yeah.
Both in my trauma recovery and in my eating disorder work. Being able to sit with the gray was really hard for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And of course it still is. It's still challenging because it's something that our brains just are not primed for in a lot of ways. But certainly not a traumatized brain. A traumatized brain very much looks at things as black and white. Mm-hmm. And so when you're in that place, it's really hard to believe that, you know, whether it's the black or the white, isn't true. It's really hard to trust that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's hard to trust anything when you're traumatized, mm-hmm. you know. So it's complicated. But, you know, I think that what I often want people to know is that there's hope, you know, that you don't always have to feel this way about your body and yourself. You know, I thought that this would be my life, or that would be my life, that I would hate myself my entire life and be fighting my body my entire life. And I don't anymore, you know, and I'm relatively young. I'm 26, you know, and like, I've got a lot of life ahead of me, and I wouldn't have that if it wasn't for recovery in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And I'm just so happy that you're sharing this, because I can imagine, you know, someone who might be listening to this, who is either fresh in the recovery or they've been struggling for a very long time, right? To hear that, okay, like, I've been there. I did not trust myself. I hated myself. I hated my body, but there's a way out, there's hope, and that, you know, that's not to say that, right, that life becomes all sunshine and rainbows after you, right? It's like, yeah, it's, shit is still hard, but you got tools, you have understanding, you have power, you have your resilience, and I think that's very powerful.
Yeah. I often describe it, especially when, like, I'm talking about depression even, like, when you're feeling depressed or you're feeling overwhelmed by beauty standards or what have you, it's like you have a pile of bricks on your chest. And then you have these tools and the bricks are here. And of course, we're on a podcast, so you can't see what I'm doing. But my hand is now above my chest rather than on it. So it's like it's hovering over you instead of crushing you with its weight. So it's not that the things disappear. We still live in this world. We still have to deal with, you know, triggers and people being disrespectful about how we want to deal with our bodies and our food and all of that. But we're not suffocated by it. We can move through it because we have healed and have the tools to do so. I think that for more marginalized people, there's this idea that, well, like, I live in this world and it's so dangerous for me, which it absolutely is. But so how could I ever recover? I'm never going to feel safe.
Mm.
And that's a completely valid thing to think. But I think it's important to remember that what my recovery looks like is going to be different than what someone else's recovery looks like. Mm. And even what my recovery looks like right now is different than what it looked like a year ago, or it's going to look like a year from now. And if we were able to move as a community away from these sort of rigid ways of defining recovery, I think we would make a lot more space for people to grow and heal in ways that work for them, and in ways that don't feel like even more pressure than the eating disorder itself.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, speaking about how recovery, right, I think it can become so black and white. You're either recovered and you're healed, or you're right. broken and sick, when right. really recovery is a journey. It's non-linear and continuous, and you're always learning more about yourself, right?
Yeah.
Year by year, it can be very solid and still learning.
Absolutely. And you know, it's again, it's sort of, we are often limited by our own perception of things, right? So like, when we're creating tools to try and heal, we're inevitably going to fall into binary thinking because that's already how we think. And so I think the recovered versus recovering binary is a good example of that. Like, it's not helpful or useful, but it makes sense why we came up with it, because it fits in with, you know, the old way of thinking. But I think in order to really create the space for all of us, or the majority of us, to have the opportunity to heal, we have to move away from that, because it's just another yardstick to beat ourselves with. And like, people who struggle with eating disorders and trauma don't need more of those, in my opinion.
Yep. Mic drop. Boom. Mic drop. Yeah. So the next thing that's been, you know, in my mind, on my heart, that you mentioned earlier, is that, you know, you took your power back when you gave back the shame, you gave back the blame, you gave back the hate to the systems that were responsible for all these feelings and the stigma and all of that. So what are some of the systems that you had to challenge? What are some beliefs that you had to dismantle? I know it's a big question, but...
Definitely. Yeah, well, I mean, I've always been in somewhat of a larger body. I mean, of course, looking back, I'm like, Ashley, you were probably the most average child, but, you know, I wasn't like a lanky string bean, so it was catastrophic. So, you know, fat phobia, I feel like, has always impacted me.
So fat phobia, right? Like, mm-hmm. people may not know. I mean, the name is quite obvious, but can you break that down for us? What is fat phobia? Because this conversation needs to happen.
Yeah, so I would define fat phobia as a fear, hatred, judgment against those in larger bodies, or those in bodies you perceive as larger than is acceptable. Because, you know, it's important to note that a lot of the fat phobia that we experience in our world now, although of course it's more intense and violent the larger a person may be, that it impacts people across the size spectrum, because it's all relative, right? If we all think we're supposed to be, you know, the smallest size available, then anyone larger than that is now a target for fat phobia. But again, caveat that the fat phobia that we experience is going to be different depending on our size and where on the size spectrum we lay. So like, the fat phobia that I experience is a lot of, unspoken stuff from people, comments, glances, actual spoken stuff from people, etc. I don't tend to experience fat phobia structurally, because I can still sit in booths. I can still use one plane seat, right? So there are, you know, I can find a chair that's going to support my weight, whereas, you know, someone who's larger than me may not. So there are, as with all marginalization and oppression, there are levels to the experience and different levels of severity. But I would say that's the general sort of overview. And, you know, fat phobia is also very deeply connected to racism. I should say that as well. And yeah, I mean, I think that's like the sort of baseline definition of fat phobia. But I think if you live in this world, like you see it every day, you turn on the TV and there's a fat joke, you know, scroll through Twitter and people are talking about Trump and his body size. And it's like, there's a million things to hate Trump for and his body size isn't one of them. You know, so anyway, yeah, that's what fat phobia is.
Thank you for the whistle stop tour of fat phobia and what it is about. But I think that point that you mentioned, right, fat phobia and racism, can you tell us a little bit more about how they're connected?
So, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to do it justice, so I should say that first and foremost. I have not read the book myself, but I've heard that Sabrina Strings is Fearing the Black Body, explores this in depth in a way that I am certainly not going to. But basically, as racial stratification changed throughout our history, specifically like early modern European history, I'm pretty sure, there was basically an attempt to continue to subjugate Black folks and Brown folks. And one of the ways that they did that was to differentiate between the kinds of bodies that were more typical. So someone who was, you know, Anglo-Saxon, I'm using air quotes for all of this because none of this is real, but Anglo-Saxon, like white, Christian, Catholic, Protestant types.
Right.
They were chaste and not sinful and thin.
Mm.
And they were, it was connected to gluttony and violence as well. And so those who were Black and Brown were thought to be larger, to have a curvier sort of physique. And so those body type value systems that were created were in many ways created to further subjugate Black and Brown people. Yeah.
Yeah. It just pisses me off.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I probably need another podcast to talk about this. But yeah, thank you for breaking that down for us a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, going back to the systems that you had to challenge, right? So there was fat phobia and you said sexism.
Yeah, the next one was going to be sexism. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I think that as women, as folks assigned female at birth, as people socialized as women, as people perceived as women, our value is in our appearance. It always is, no matter what. You know, I mean, I was the quote smart girl growing up, but it didn't matter how smart I was because no one wanted to date me. No one had a crush on me, right? Mm-hmm. Like it was like I was just not valuable because I wasn't deemed desirable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of what we grapple with constantly. And then, you know, it can be then, what's the word I'm looking for? Compounded. Yeah, I think so. Compounded by other forms of oppression. So like Black women, for example, experience misogynoir, and that's sort of an even more specific and violent form of misogyny that Black women specifically experience, that hypersexualizes them as well as, you know, mammifies them and all of that. For me, my intersection is Jewishness. And so, you know, I think in a lot of ways, the desire to be desired mm-hmm. coupled with the fact that I will never and have never fit typical beauty standards simply because I have Semitic features, like it's kind of unmistakable, has made it so that like I was never gonna fit the beauty standard. I was never gonna get there.
The beauty standard being
white, Christian, thin, wealthy, what else?
Hair color? Is there a specific hair color?
Blonde.
Eye color?
Blonde. Yep. Blue eye, blonde. You're right. I'm sorry. Aryans. Duh. Yeah.
Like a size zero.
Right. Size zero, right? Non-textured hair, too. The texture of hair is a big thing as well. As well as where your fat is distributed. You know,
Like
I have more privilege than someone who has, you know, less of a small waist. Like I tend to have a more classic, like hourglass, quote unquote figure. And that's deemed as more attractive, you know? So there's so many different forms of oppression really that come together to just make us feel like we're not enough ever. I'm also queer, but I don't feel that has personally for me really impacted my sense of like internal beauty. Mm-hmm. Although I will say that like when I was sort of feeling rebellious, I was like, well, I like people of all genders. So like, who cares if men find me attractive? So like that was a helpful push in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that it affected my ability to feel wanted in the way that my gender and my ethnicity and my fatness did.
Mm.
But of course, that's a personal experience. I'm also pretty straight passing, and I've only been in straight passing relationships. So that could also be a factor as well.
Hmm. Well, and what do you mean by straight passing?
Sure. So my partner is a cisgender male. I am a cisgender female. And so from the outside world, we look like a straight couple. Both of us are queer, though, and queer identifying. So technically, it's not a straight couple. But for the outside world, that's how it appears. So
yeah.
I often will use, straight passing or straight passing is usually the phrase that I use. Similar to white passing or white functioning. You know, like as I mentioned, I'm Jewish and, pretty pointedly Semitic features. And my skin is on the lighter side, certainly now, since I haven't been outside for like 2 years. I, especially because I live in the United States, when I walk out the door, I'm not in danger because of my skin color or my Semitic features. That's just not mm-hmm. the reality for mm-hmm. me. I have white passing privilege, white functioning privilege, white privilege, however you want
right,
to frame
right.
it.
Right, right, yeah.
And I'm also a Jew, and arguably Jews have never been considered white. So it's like, it's all very complicated and weird in terms of self-identification and how others tend to describe you. But so I think it's important that as a lighter-skinned Jew, that we, as lighter-skinned Jews, plural, acknowledge the fact, especially those of us living in the United States, that there is a privilege to that, and that our experience is different than other ethnic minorities in the country.
Mm.
So, yeah.
So how do you perceive yourself now as a Jewish woman in a bigger body?
How would I describe myself?
As in, are you, I guess, more at peace?
Yeah, absolutely. My Jewish identity is not something that I've ever felt shameful about. I grew up in a somewhat, for Jews, a somewhat highly densely Jewishly populated area. Okay. I mean, I'm from New York, and I grew up in Westchester, so there's a lot of Jews there.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel like the odd man out in that sense. However, I am what I like to call a mixed mutt Jew. So
What does that even mean?
So basically there are many Jewish sects. So depending on where your family settled post-diaspora, and so half of my family post-diaspora settled in Europe, which makes them Ashkenazi, and then the other half of my family post-diaspora settled elsewhere in the Middle East, which makes me, and as well as Spain, which makes me Sephardic and Mizrahi. So I look like the Sephardic Mizrahi side of my family, which is why I'm somewhat of a more olive skin tone. I have, like, you know, the more like classical Jewish nose type situation going on.
Which is what? Which is what?
Which is what?
What is a classical Jewish nose?
Like, well, so like it's the way that the nose either bends or doesn't at the end. So like there's the hook nose.
Oh God.
Type thing. I don't have, well, I kind of do a little bit, but, and then like the bumps at the top is also classically considered like a Jew nose.
Okay.
So I look more Jewish. I look more Semitic, and that's in many ways, I look more like the Sephardic Mizrahi side of my family. And so, even though there was a large Jewish population where I lived, I felt somewhat like the minority in that I looked different than a lot of my Jewish friends because they were all Ashkis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I should preface it by saying not all of them. Like one of my very best friends, one of my good close Jewish friends, his father is Middle Eastern and not Jewish. So he also looked very different from the other Jews in the community. But I think that difference often showed itself in certain ways. Like I would be more cognizant of anti-Semitism and be more of an active target of it than some of my Ashki friends have. And so, you know, I'll try to talk to them sometimes about experiencing anti-Semitism and they've never experienced it, you know, and that's a good thing. Right. But it just points to that, like, even within the same community, our experience is different, right? And like my experience is different from a Jew of color, like a Black Jew, a Chinese Jew, et cetera. Like, you know, that is a completely different experience too. So there's a lot of complicated messiness to talking about Jewishness.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, we could, I mean, everything that you named, right? All the systems, and I feel like just as one podcast, we're limited here. We can't really dive deeply, right? Yeah. So you said that writing was one way that you took back your power, right? So how did you start to challenge the system or the systems?
Yeah, plural. I mean, I was doing that from a very young age, if I'm honest. Like, I mean, when I was young, I wanted to be like a human rights lawyer. Like that was my, like,
yeah, that was what you wanted to be.
Yeah. My perspective on things was always very justice oriented. You know, like I was also the odd man out in my family often because of that. You know, so I think from a young age, I was pushing back against those things. But like I said, I think that in my early adolescence and like sort of teenagehood, the desire to be accepted overrode anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I had to sort of come back to that eventually. And I lost that for a little while, that sort of justice oriented perspective. But yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, I was doing reports on marriage equality in like the eighth grade. You know, like I've sort of always been that girl in class who's like, but what about blah blah blah.
Yeah, and I think even on your Instagram page, right, the artwork that you're creating, the messages that you're sharing, I see how you're taking a stand, right, against oppressive messages that's out there.
Yeah, I mean, I try. I certainly am not perfect at it, and I don't succeed in all cases. But, you know, I think for me, when it comes down to it, it's like, well, why am I here? I'm here to not make the world a better place, but like, I'm certainly not here to make it worse.
Yeah.
You know? So like, I want to try, and I want to, I also, you know, it's one of the reasons why I became a therapist. I want to be the person that I wish I had had when I was younger.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it boils down to that. And wanting to protect others from the harm that I experienced. Now, as a social worker and clinician, I've sort of had to learn that I can't really do that. you know, I have to sort of accept that like harm will happen to people, and we have to sort of mm-hmm. trust in their resiliency and their ability to cope and, excuse me, and survive mm-hmm. against all odds. Mm-hmm. And I also think that, you know, my Jewish studies have helped with that too. I mean, the Jewish people have, against all odds, somehow continued to exist. So, you know, I think I tend to sort of bring that into my work as well. You know, that we never give up, because to give up is to die.
Mm-hmm. To give up is to die.
Maybe. I don't know.
To give up is to die. Yeah, and I think sometimes we have to hit that rock bottom, right, before we can start to rise, because it's often in those moments where there's a sense of surrender. You're like, you know what? It just can't get worse from here, and something's got to change.
Definitely. I think surrender is a great word, and I think we have to surrender in many ways. We have to surrender our biases, our beliefs, our hopes, our wishes, because in a lot of ways, those hopes and wishes aren't ours. You know, they're somebody else's, and they're someone else's priorities. And mm-hmm. so when we let all of it go, we can make a lot more space to figure out what's actually important to us.
Yeah. And, you know, what is one thing that you had to surrender, you know, in order for you to get to where you are today? Or maybe one thing that you have to surrender every day?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I mean, I had to surrender my beauty ideals. You know, I had to let them go, because even if I was in a small body, I was never going to be that, mm-hmm. you know? And the more, and the bigger my body got, the more obvious that became. Like, I often feel like many of my Semitic features become more prominent when I'm larger. Perhaps that's internalized anti-Semitism. I don't know, but it's sort of my perception of it. And so I think in a lot of ways, my desire to shrink my body was my desire to shrink those features. Although, you know, metaphysically, that's not possible. That's what I thought I was doing. and so, you know, I had to sort of let go that I was going to be this, you know, movie type archetype of a teenage girl in America.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that,
it was holding me back so much, and I had to let it go. And it was just not me.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think it takes confidence, right? And also self-trust to be able to say, I don't want to fit in anymore. Mm. I want to belong so thoroughly to myself.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, wanting to belong, whether it's to ourselves or to our communities, is a very natural desire. It's something that I try to normalize for my patients, you know? Mm. It's when hunter-gatherer times, if you weren't accepted by the group, you were cast aside and you died. Yeah. So being accepted is literally a survival mechanism. And humans are primed for nothing if not survival. And sometimes that gets in our way. And it hurts us.
Yeah.
And we have to be able to discern, like, what communities are really for us and which ones aren't.
Yeah. Agreed.
And I would say that, like, I wasn't very confident when I began making these shifts. It was more just, like, I don't have another choice.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like it was continue killing myself slowly, mm-hmm. or make a different choice.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you made the different choice.
Me too.
Right. So, your Instagram handle is Fat Positive Therapy.
Indeed.
What is Fat Positive Therapy?
That's a great question. Why are you laughing? Well, because I didn't think about it when I put the handle together. Like,
really?
This is a kind of therapy, but like I've had a number of people ask me that, and I'm like, I don't even really know. But what it really is a weight inclusive approach, right? Like, I want my patients to know that when they come to me, I am here for their bodies in whatever way, shape, or form that they currently are, you know, and I am not going to be offering solutions, quote unquote, that are focused on manipulating your body. That's the sort of baseline. You know, like, I've had some people reach out to me and ask, like, is it okay if I'm still trying to lose weight? Like, can I still work with you? And it's like, absolutely. You know, I believe in body autonomy. You do what works for you and what you think is best for you. But I am not going to encourage you to try and lose weight intentionally or shift your body in a way that isn't sort of naturally occurring. And that's sort of my perspective on it. Because, you know, I belong to a lot of Facebook groups and other kinds of online forums of other therapists. And I noticed that, like, in the therapy world, there's so much weight stigma. I mean, there's still this perpetuating belief that people who are in larger bodies are in larger bodies because they're holding on to trauma. Or they're not ready to be attractive to others. Like, it's just, there's so much of this, like, really gross fat phobia in the therapy counseling, you know, professional circles. Uh-huh. And so I sort of wanted my practice, my whatever, to be a clear safe haven for people who are not interested in that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that space is so important, right? To feel like they can bring all of themselves to you and not feel like they have to hide or be ashamed of whatever it is that they are dealing with when it comes to their body.
Yeah. And I will say that, like, you know, having my handle be Fat Positive Therapy, like, some people get scared that I'm too much of a fat activist, and like, they back off because they're like, I'm not ready for that. And that's totally their right. But I think, you know, I've been trying to really let any of my patients know that, like, I'm not here to push an agenda. I'm just here to make space for you in whatever way it needs to be made.
So if someone comes to see you and they are, you know, unwell and very, very underweight or thin, right? What would a conversation around, you know, weight gain and changes in their body, you know, what does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a lot of coping. It's a lot, you know, because we have to remember that eating disorders are coping. Trying to maintain and manipulate our body size is coping. It's a way to try and maintain control. It's a way to try and keep ourselves safe. And so, you know, I often will say to my patients, like, I'm not necessarily looking for you to stop behaviors at this very moment. That could be dangerous for you. I want us to start to create space for you to start choosing something different. Mm-hmm. And we have to have different options available for that to even happen. So it's a lot of skills building and building out that coping skills tool chest, as well as community and connecting them with people who are also struggling with this, who are also trying to change the way that they view beauty, as well as the social media feed adjustments that I mentioned previously. I always recommend that for people. Mm-hmm. And lastly, health at every size research. Mm-hmm. Like the book Anti-Diet is really great. Has a whole chapter on diet culture and how we've gotten where we are. I think it's super helpful, again, to sort of remember who the real problem is,
yeah.
aka not you. Another good one is Body Respect. There is still some healthism in Body Respect, if I recall from last reading it, but, you know, regardless, it's a pretty good resource and really talks about and debunks a lot of the, you know, health science that many of us hold as gospel right now. Those are like the main things. And then lastly is just like, when you're going through this process of trying to allow your body to be, instead of trying to make it what you want it to be, a lot of emotions come up, confusing emotions,
yeah.
conflicting emotions. And so I often recommend that people journal through it and really try to like get down onto paper what this means for them to see their body change and what it threatens, what it, you know, what pain it brings up. And validate that, because again, like, we don't do this to our bodies just for the fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing it to try and stay safe.
Yeah. Because without safety, where would we be? Right?
Well, right. I mean, without safety, you can't heal. You can't, without having some lifeline, some kind of coping that helps you feel safe, you're constantly in that hypervigilant fight or flight way
yeah.
of being.
Yeah.
And that way of being, it very much forces you into black and white thinking, into, you know, acting before you've really thought through what the repercussions might be. Like, we do things that maybe aren't the most helpful for us when we're in that fight or flight place. And so finding safety is essential, because you can't really make, well, I shouldn't say you can't, because there's absolutely work that can be done when you still feel unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for people who are multiply marginalized, it's more likely that they will feel unsafe.
Yeah.
But it's really hard if you don't have some kind of lifeline to safety, even, you know, however small it may be.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we have to sadly bring our conversation to an end soon because of our time, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, safety, right? So because, you know, part of healing and recovery is learning to feel safe in your body and in the world again, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what are some ways or some things that you do that allow you to feel safe in yourself and also in this world? Big question. So many big questions.
Well, especially now. I mean, I know we've talked about this offline, but just the what's happening current events wise, it's a constant feeling of unsafety.
Yeah.
I think the biggest thing is finding your safety, whether that's a human, an activity, a resource, having some kind of grounding element. You know, my partner is my safe place in
yeah.
many ways. And whenever I'm feeling unhinged, he's the person I go to sort of just let it all out. And I know that no matter what comes out of my mouth, like, he's gonna be supportive. So having those people, whether it's like a text thread of your friends or a partner or your mom or your dad or your sister or your brother or whatever, like, having someone that you know is going to grant you the grace that you need in times of crisis. Because again, like, sometimes we're not our best selves in those moments. And so, you know, you need someone that knows you and knows that your intentions are good, right? Like, we talk a lot about impact versus intent in the social justice world, and I think it's an important conversation to have. And we also have to have people in our lives who know that our intent is good, even when things don't come out the way we want them to, or if our impact doesn't, you know, match. So I think creating that kind of community safety is really essential. And you can even create that community online. I mean, like I have a small little group chat, for example, with just some friends that I've made on the internet who are fat positive, progressive, Zionist Jews, you know, and that's a very rare intersection. Yeah. There's a lot of fat phobia in the Jewish community. There's a lot of anti-Semitism in the fat positive community. And so like it's hard to find people that you feel safe with and who are going to give you the benefit of the doubt and who are going to talk about those weird, complicated topics with you. But when you have that, it feels less scary and you feel less alone. And I think when you feel less scared and less alone, you create space for more opportunity for safety.
Yeah. Yeah. I so agree. It's that common humanity, right?
Yeah.
That when you, because there's so much shame involved in eating disorders and the whole recovery process. So
yeah, mental illness in general. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So whether it's reading a book even and hearing someone's story.
Yeah. I love podcasts too. For that, like, because a lot of them are like something in food psych, which is a very popular podcast in our professional circle. Their interview style, and they're focused on people's stories. And it can be really helpful to remember that, like, as unique and wonderful and special as we are as humans, our experiences are not unique. They're very universal.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we hear from people who have struggled like we have, at least for me, it has created a lot more safety.
Yeah.
I think that's how a lot of it really started for me. I mean, food psych was huge in maintaining my recovery efforts, because it offered me insight into other people's journeys.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you for sharing your story. You know, I think stories, they're incredibly powerful because I think they access, you know, a different part of our psyche.
Mm-hmm.
And ourselves. So, you know, whoever might be listening to this in the near future when this is out, please know that you're not alone and you're seen, you know, you're seen and understood.
Mm, yeah. And I think for me, being seen and heard for so long, that was all I wanted. And I think for a lot of us, it's all we want.
Yeah. Yeah. I see you. I hear you. I see you. I hear you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Ashley.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for having me.
Alrighty. Bye.